Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
I'm HRN's Communications Director Kat Johnson with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. We decided it's high time we do an episode about Mary Jane.
Marijuana, things are happening.
That's right. This episode is about pot. We're exploring the rhetoric surrounding legalization in New York's recent gubernatorial primaries. And a cheesemonger turned cannabis consultant shares the tricks of the trade.
Great. So do you want to conquer the world? Do you want to have hazy eyes? Do you want to, you know, just relax all day and be floaty?
And we find out how one exemplary South Carolina farmer is trying his hand at a new crop.
Every plant that comes up from seed is different. And so it's learning how the plant grows, how it responds, and then familiarizing myself and my senses with this plant.
Plus, Hannah Forden and I taste test the hottest new cocktail ingredient, CBD. So subscribe to Meat and Three wherever you listen to podcasts and be the first to know when the newest episode of Meat and Three drops.
Hello, this is Dana Cowan, and you are listening to Speaking Broadly on Heritage Radio Network. Each week, I interview an extraordinary person in the food and hospitality industry and learn their secrets to success, what makes them happy, what makes them feel challenged and excited. And today, I have one of my favorite people in the entire culinary universe with me, Dori Greenspan. Dori is an incredible inspiration in the kitchen. I famously I'm not a great cook. And Dori's instructions in her 13 cookbooks are so clear and so inviting that I actually feel nurtured and helped along the way. And things actually turn out pretty well. So welcome, Dori.
Thank you.
So we're here in part to celebrate and talk about Everyday Dori. I would love to have some Dori in my life every single day. I mean, that would be amazing.
You want to talk to my kid about this? He had me every day for a lot of days. I bet you there were times when, yeah.
Well, I mean, that brings us so immediately to one of the centerpieces that I think makes your world so enticing, is that when you have a cookbook, there's an entire world that you become a part of, because your cookbooks are really a conversation. And I was wondering, like, what your thought is about, you know, conversation. When you were growing up in Brooklyn, was the table the place of conversation for you?
Oh, Dana. No.
No conversations at all?
No. Dinner was, first of all, my mother didn't cook. There was always food, but somebody once said to me, asked me, what was my favorite meal that my mother made? And I was a grown-up, and it was then that I realized that I didn't have a favorite meal because she didn't cook.
What did you eat?
We ate a three-course meal every evening at 6 o'clock.
Okay.
And there was an appetizer, there was a main course with vegetables, and there was a dessert.
That sounds very formal.
It sounds very formal. We had to ask to be excused from the table, and we ate quickly and asked to be excused quickly. Yeah, it wasn't, that was, and it's interesting, because my mom loved food, loved to go out, just enjoyed food. She just never wanted to, and she liked to shop for it.
Uh-huh.
She just didn't want to cook it. And I had two brothers, and no one was happy at the table.
Wow.
So it wasn't anything that I grew up with. But I got married as a college student, and all I wanted was to learn how to cook so that I could have friends come visit. And I don't know exactly where they came from, but that was really what I wanted. I wanted to have people around the table. I wanted to cook for them. I wanted them to just enjoy being together. And that hasn't changed.
And that just comes through in every single book that you've written, because the goal is you cook it and you share it.
Yes.
So I am curious. So you met your husband, Michael, and you got married at 19.
Yeah, I met him when I was 16.
Okay. So I need to know, what did you see in Michael at 16?
Oh, I didn't see anything in him at 16. I thought he was just kind of geeky and nerdy and not for me.
No.
And so it was... But he was nice, which is a horrible
thing. Yeah, that's
thing.
The worst
terrible,
word.
Terrible, terrible,
terrible.
But, you know, he was nice, and we became friends. And it was really interesting because he went off. I graduated from high school. He went off to graduate school in California. And we wrote to one another. And we really got to know one another writing to one another.
Is he a lovely writer?
He is a lovely writer. He really is a lovely writer.
You really can understand how someone's able to express themselves that way, which is, you find out more about their inside than their outside.
Yes, and so we lived two blocks away from one another, and we could see one another's bedroom windows. And so he would call me. I had a phone that rang only in my room. And, you know, I'm living home with my parents.
Right.
But when he saw that my light was on, he would call. And we would just talk. And we would talk as friends. And then, as I said, he went away to school and we wrote letters to one another. And when he came back, it was having my best friend come home. And everything changed that way.
And how did you decide to make a commitment at 19, which seems early? And was there...
Oh, it's so early. Women out there, don't get married at 19. It's so early. Michael says that we saw one another Christmas Eve and that we were talking about getting married New Year's Eve. And we did. I mean, none of my friends was married. It was a time when you lived at home until you got married. If I had gotten married 1 year later, it might have been different. We might not have gotten married. But it
Why
was
is
just
that?
On the cusp. It was just on the cusp of things changing. And we got married. We were the first people to get married, the first people to in our little circle in Brooklyn to live together, to have an apartment. And I was still a student, so I had plenty of time. All I wanted to do was learn to cook. And
this strikes me as sort of extraordinary.
Well, I didn't think about it. It's just what I wanted. Looking back, I see it as why. But I think it was all about the people. I just wanted to have a place. My friends had always congregated in my home when I lived with my parents. Uh-huh. And I loved having friends around. And food seemed like... the way to do it.
It's a really good way to get people over. And then you can talk all night and you create such a great sense of community. So you and Michael, and we'll stop talking about him at some point, but the two of you are so such an elegant and seemingly perfect match. I know nothing's perfect in this world.
My grandmother would say poo 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 that you say. Or touch wood or something, because if you say, something is perfect, that's when it breaks. But we've been together a long time.
And what's the secret?
I don't, if I knew, wouldn't that be great?
Yeah, that would be your next project. That,
and I would share it. I would shout it from rooftops.
Yeah.
I don't know. There is no secret. And there is, it looks good. It is good. But there are plenty of hard times. There have been plenty of hard times. And, I imagine there will be again. That's just what life is. But I think, boy, you better like whoever you're married to.
Yeah, I think liking is such it seems so obvious, but so many other things are in play in love, There are two letters missing. You change them out, and it's a very dramatic,
I think
difference.
You really have to like one another. And I think we got lucky because the odds were against us. It was, we were so young. Michael had his first job, And I was...
Well, you're figuring it out, right?
Figuring it out together.
Now, I love the idea that you studied gerontology. I mean, you have a master's in gerontology.
I do.
And you almost have a doctorate in gerontology, which is the study of old people.
And maybe I could spell it now. I don't remember.
Is that because you're feeling geriatric? You don't remember?
Well, I keep thinking, you know, I should have finished because, boy, I could use it now. But,
I was wondering, like, when you turned away from gerontology, I was wondering if it had something to do with this notion of conversation that we've been, you know, dancing around, like bringing people together. That's a very one-sided conversation when, you know, with
that's interesting.
With
I
old
had
people.
No, I think I made the decision more. Well, I certainly made it selfishly. I was working on my doctorate when Joshua, our son, was born. And I stayed home with him, and I also had a job. And I was supposed to, at a research center, and I was supposed to go back to it, and I just didn't want to. And it was Michael, the wonderful Michael, the guy I like, who said, he said, you know, you love baking. Why don't you bake? And that never seemed like a possibility to me. It didn't seem like a possibility because I wasn't trained. I didn't feel confident about getting a job. There weren't all that many women. There were two, maybe, in the kitchen at the time. I didn't know how to do it. You know, I knew how to be a student. I knew how to do the work I was doing. So it was a little scary. But he said, this is what you really love. Yeah. Why don't you do it?
And do you think that the intersection of the two, you know, when I think about your extraordinary career, the intersection of the master's or the doctorate and what you're doing is you are an extraordinary student. Like when I think about the people that you've learned from and how you've chosen the path of study. So Pierre Hermé, you know, you did two books with probably at the time and perhaps still the greatest pastry chef that existed. Or you know, you went to France. You didn't have typical training, but the way that you have been a student in your life has shaped your life.
Very much so. The other day I was working on something and Michael walked by and he said, I thought you were done. And I said, yeah, well, I was kind of done, but I had another idea. And he said, you know, you're a grind. And, you know, he said it lovingly and tousled my head afterward. But I love to study. When... favorite leading line. When I worked with Julia Child,
yeah.
but when I worked with Julia, she said to me, one day we were in the supermarket, and she said, we're so lucky to be working in food. And I could think of a million reasons why she would have said that. And I looked at her and said, Julia, she said, because we'll never stop learning. And it's true, in food there's always something to learn, whether it's a technique or it's learning about a new dish or it's going deeper into a culture, or it's endlessly fascinating and there's always something more.
It's true, and it evolves, which is nice. So you're not just studying the past.
That's right.
And you're not studying something with an end point. I have to ask about Julie because I, you know, had the pleasure of working with her the slightest little bit. I bet you do a great Julia accent. Like Julia,
I do. No, not at all. Can't.
You can't?
Can't. Never have been able to.
Why
have never
not?
Done it.
Dory, I can't believe that you can't do a Julia accent.
We were once at a conference. I was sitting next to Julia, and somebody was doing a Julia imitation. And Julia turned to me and said, I don't sound like that, do I? I said, but Julia, you do. That was good, Dana.
So she... You know, she's sort of taught herself to cook and taught America to cook, but she had some blind spots. Did you find her an exceptional cook? Because there's a lot of controversy about that.
Ooh, we made tuna salad together.
Yeah.
I don't... Oh, you know, I've never thought about that. I've never thought about that. She worked... so beautifully with, so I worked on the project Baking with Julia, so it was 27 bakers and pastry chefs who were with her in her home in Cambridge, and then I wrote the book, but she was so good with them. She was so curious. She had all the right questions. She knew what they were working on. She knew it from experience. She knew it from studying it. I don't know if she was a good cook.
That's interesting.
We never made anything other than that tuna salad. Though she would come into the kitchen sometimes at night after a shoot. We would either eat what was left over, or there would be somebody coming in, a new chef for the following day, and we'd cook. And she always added something by being in the kitchen. But I've never had a fully Julia-ized meal. Ooh.
And do you feel, was there something about the way that she drew chefs out that is interesting for you that you learned as a way to learn?
Julia, I don't know if I learned something about drawing chefs out from her, but she had a quality that I think about all the time, and it's so rare to find. When Julia talked to you, she looked directly at you, and you felt, and I think she did too, that there was no one else in the room. She cared just about what you were saying at that time. And she was so curious about everything. And I'd been with her, and I've seen so many interviews where the journalist, the reporter, the TV person, whatever, is asking her questions. Mm-hmm. And she's answering, and she'll look and she'll say, "So tell me, Dana, what do you think about this? How did you do this?" And it's not, I never felt it was a trick. Mm-hmm. I felt she was truly interested. And so she, from natural instinct, from caring about other people, and she really did, I think she was able to bring out.
So you learned, you worked side by side with Pierre Aimé.
Yes.
And would you say, was that your deepest pastry education before you, did as much baking on your own, or?
But I came to pastry through the Gaston Lenotre cookbook that was translated and had all of the classics, and not all of them, but it had all the classic doughs, all the classic batters, all the classic creams. It was very, encyclopedic in the way it was. It wasn't a big book, but it covered the basics in a very orderly way. And I worked my way through that book so that by the time I worked with Pierre, I had done the Julia Child project. I had worked with Jean-Georges von Gersten's pastry chef. And so...
Was that not Johnny?
No, early. His first pastry chef, Jean-Marc Bourrier, who died way too young. And so I had knowledge, but I hadn't really been able to use it in the way that I could when I worked with Pierre. It was nice to know when I worked with Pierre. It was good to know that all of that study was the right thing to do. I came in knowing things.
So if someone was going to try to, take the short course, cook the book to learn pastry today, what book would you choose? Could be your own, could be somebody else's, could be a Gaston Lenotre list.
That's interesting. I think the Lenotre book is still an important book. It may not be the desserts that you would make from it. It might not be what you want to eat right now, but the techniques are there, and it's still the way. It was Karim who said that the sister art to pastry is architecture. And you see that as you work through Lenotre's book. You see how you make a cake that's the base cake, and then, and it's got to hold up the rest of the... It was very, very interesting. I would look at that. I thought Baking with Julia was a great baking course. That book covered artisan bread baking before we just let those words, just fly off our tongues. So it had savory baking. It had the basics. It's a very good baking text. And I think the first Pierre Hermé book, Pierre's Recipes, again, you know, we've all changed. He's changed as well. But boy, they're good.
They're so good. I remember because I was at Food and Wine, and I love the fact that when you, your first piece that you ever did in 1983 was at Food and Wine. I wasn't there. Some people are like, really? You were there forever. I wasn't there in 1983. But that wise editor who assigned you your first piece, even though you had never, ever written before.
That's right.
Did it feel like it took nerve to send that pitch in?
Well, you know, I didn't.
And you sent the bait?
Because I didn't know how to write a pitch. I didn't know what it was. And somebody had suggested that I do it, and I didn't know how. So I had, I remember the title of the piece was Fireside Sweets, and they were just small little pastries, and there was a truffle in there. And I didn't know what to do, so I made all of it, put it in a basket, and brought it to the reception desk at Food and Wine.
I think that's great. And they were very wise. Very wise. Someone had very good taste buds.
Well, that was the start for me. I was so grateful.
And you were talking about little sweets, which makes me think of Beurre et Sel, because that is the company that you started with your son, Joshua. And they were little cookies.
So, you know, it took me, I can't remember how many years I was married, which means how many years I've been cooking, when I finally had the courage to make a roast. I used to only cook things that I could hold in my hand.
Let's stop there. Why was that?
I don't know. I mean, I felt like I had control over small things, you know, a Cornish hen rather than a chicken, you know, a hamburger rather than a meatloaf. I was always a miniaturist in some way.
I'm sure there's more to that, because maybe it seems less daunting, or if you know, you can succeed exquisitely or you can fail minutely, you know, like <That's> it's...
What a great way of putting it. But yeah, so cookies were always, Beurre et Sel was a cookie business, and cookies were always a favorite of mine and certainly of Joshua's, who now calls himself Josh, but I can't quite do it.
So I'd love to hear about the birth of that business. I remember going to visit you, I think, and my memory might not serve correctly, but you did a pop-up in a hair salon.
Yeah, that sounds... That
doesn't sound pleasant.
It sounds terrible, but it was really quite beautiful.
It was beautiful on Park Avenue.
It was on Park Avenue. It was at Mizu Salon, because that's where we knew someone. And they had front space, and they said, sure. And so...
What year was that, Tori?
You know, I don't know.
Is it like 2012?
I think it could have been earlier than that even.
I just feel like you preceded the pop-up, right? Like, you basically did a cookie pop-up way before all these chefs decided the pop-up was the thing.
You know, it's so funny. Joshua said, we could do this as a pop-up. And I said to him, what's a pop-up?
You were that early. Exactly.
We were early. You're right.
And who thinks of this magnificent cookbook author as the lady who, you know, was so ahead of her time, she did a pop-up.
I had a cool son. I still have a cool son. He's still cool. So we did it there. We baked. We rented a kitchen in Long Island City. It was so cold. That kitchen was so cold and so big. And we had friends, and we had volunteers, and we had people who said, let's just, and we baked through the night, and were so surprised when we sold everything out, and then had to do it all over again.
Right. Well, of course, because you cook nonstop, and in the second half of the show, we'll talk about, like, cooking in your book, and but just thinking about the difference between testing a recipe, or, you know, making something you get to give it away to the neighbors, versus, I remember you had very beautiful packaging for
that
the cookies.
That was Joshua. It was beautiful.
It was beautiful.
Yeah, and it was relentless.
And you ended up in, I call it the hot bread kitchen space, but you ended up opening Bricks and Mortar.
That's right.
Right?
That's right.
And then the business didn't work out. Or you chose not to pursue it.
Yeah, it was Joshua had, he tore his Achilles tendon. And I was still writing and doing books, and it was just a confluence of things that made it harder and harder to turn up and bake those cookies and get them out. But what a great experience. And
did you enjoy the retail aspect of it? Because I know how much you like people. You sell cookies to people.
No. I preferred the, in that case, I preferred the baking. The baking.
But it's a lot. So,
And actually, that's not true. I mean, it was always, I'm not very good at retail because I think you're supposed to sell what you've got. And
did you find all the flaws? You're like, well, that one's a little too blonde and that one's a little too dark.
Oh, Dana, you know me too well. But also, I thought the people who came to buy our cookies were interesting. And so I would be talking to them and there would be a line and, you know, Joshua would come and say, I'll take over now, Mom.
What was it like to work with your adored son?
It was difficult.
Yeah.
It was difficult. We're both glad we did it.
What was the hard part? Like, what is it that, you know, made it something that you feel like you
learned?
Were,
there were a million hard parts, actually. Yeah. But there were also some really great parts. And I think it was interesting for us. I mean, he was grown, but still, you know, my only little kid. And I think our relationship grew tremendously then, and we came to understand one another better, appreciate each other's talents, know each other's flaws very deeply. It changed our relationship. It was hard for a while, then it was good, and closing the business was wrenching.
And is that because you didn't entirely see eye to eye on whether it should close, or just
no,
you'd been through it together?
We wanted more. There were things we still wanted to do, and we understood that we had to close.
Yeah.
And it felt like unfinished business, unfinished dreams.
And if it is an unfinished business or dream, would you ever go back to it in a different?
I say no. Actually, I say no so quickly, and that's kind of become a family joke to just say no immediately when asked about this.
Yeah.
But Joshua and I talked about it actually just a few months ago. I don't know. No, comma maybe.
That's a very, very big distance from no exclamation point, which is where we started.
Yeah. I'm not sure. Yeah. There were so many good parts about it. And the cookies. I loved the cookies.
And how did you choose the cookies that you did to be your signature cookies? Because you did the jammers.
I love the classic jammers, right.
You want to describe like what a classic jammer is and why that was so perfect?
So the cookies that we made at Burnsell were, we baked them in rings. So they were all, no matter what we did to them, they were all beautiful because the rings contained them and made them all the same size so that we could stack them in these beautiful tubes that had been designed. And the jammer was a sablé, a French butter cookie with some really nice fleur de sel in it, about half an inch high. And in the center, there was jam. And all around the jam, there was crunchy streusel, brown sugar streusel.
So
it was a great cookie. It was a great cookie.
And did that evolve from your imagination?
My dream. I had a dream.
You did not.
I woke up in the middle of the night. We were in Paris, and I, you know, kind of elbowed Michael, and I said, I think I just created a cookie. And he said, that's nice. He's kind of like used to my getting up in the middle of the night saying crazy things. But the following morning, I baked that cookie.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's never happened to me. You know,
again?
Again, and it hadn't happened before.
But I will say another story about where a dream rescues you is before you went to cook with Martha Stewart, and you woke up and had a revelation that...
This was more a nightmare than the beautiful jammer dream. Yeah, I had a feeling that something was wrong with the recipe. And I got up and made the recipe, and it didn't work. And I thought, okay, it's just because I'm tired. And I made it two more times. It didn't work. It was missing an egg.
It's an amazing thing that your brain could wake you up and say, wait a minute, maybe there's something not right
it's
here.
Crazy. It's crazy because that came out of, that recipe was in Baking Chez Moi. It was for speculoos. There were 200 recipes in that book. Why would, and I don't have such a great memory. I don't know what it was. It was crazy.
Okay, with that, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we are going to talk about this extraordinary new cookbook, Every Day with Dory. And you're going to get some tantalizing recipes. So stay with us.
Oh, won't you save all your pumpkin pie? Oh, won't you save all your pumpkin pie? Oh, won't you save all your pumpkin pie just for me, girl? Please don't give none away. Let it get sweeter by the day.
Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. The Hearst family has been raising cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of California's Central Coast for over 150 years. Piedra Blanca Rancho in San Simeon is the original Hearst Ranch, founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst. In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, "I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world." Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, the working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
Welcome back to Speaking Broadly. You're listening to Dana Cowan, your host. And today I have with me as my guest, Dory Greenspan, who is publishing in a couple of days a cookbook called Everyday Dory. So as I started this podcast, I would like to be with you every day. The thing that struck me in the introduction, you say how writing cookbooks makes you happy. And I just get the feeling that you do what makes you happy. Feeding people makes you happy. Writing recipes makes you happy. Cooking makes you happy. Were you always happy?
No, and I'm not always happy.
Then maybe that's why it stands out that writing cookbooks does make you happy.
Well, I recently said that I feel I was very lucky, and somebody, I must have written it on a blog post or something, and somebody wrote to me and said, you're not lucky. You know, you had this, you had that. And I thought, my mother used to say that no matter what you do, you need some luck. And I think that's true. I think it's great when you've practiced and you're ready for the luck to come. But I've always, since I started writing cookbooks, I felt that I was lucky to be able to do this work, that I had found work that I really loved. I mean, that's what we hope for our children, that they'll find work that's what we hope for everyone who's close to us.
I like what you said, that we have to prepare for luck. I very much believe in that. I hear so much about, you know, these entrepreneurs, and if they leap and the net appears, or if the door doesn't open, jump out the window. And I think, well, that's good, but actually you need the parachute if you're going to jump out the window and wait for the net to appear. Like, somehow you need to spend your time in your back room knitting your parachute. And so, like, for you, what is the knitting the parachute? Like, how did you prepare for the luck to enter your life?
I think it comes back to my being a grunt. I worked. Yeah. I was, having made the decision not to stay in school, not to have a job as a research person, that was a big leap. And then I worked at it.
Right.
I studied, I experimented. I spent a lot of time in the kitchen. I wrote. I did the work that I wanted to do, but it also meant that when an opportunity came, I've never felt ready for anything that's come along. I'm always sure that they've chosen the wrong person. I'm always sure that I'll never be able to do this.
That's part of what's so charming. I'd love to, because it's true. Like, I do know you well enough to know that there's always the other side. That's why when you woke up in the middle of the night and you said there must be something wrong with this Bakulous cookie, I assumed there really wasn't, but it was just you.
I'm a warrior. I'm a warrior. But I've kind of pushed myself to always say yes, because I want the experience. And then I'll work to make it work. But so when something comes along and I've, you know, steeled myself and said yes, that's when all the stuff that I did before, you know, holds me up.
So actually, I think this goes back to your description of pastry actually being an exercise in architecture. And I think that what you're actually saying is your career is also an exercise in architecture, because you've laid so much groundwork
when something new
comes along, you're creating the dome, but you have the pillars and you have the groundwork that makes it so that you can succeed.
Yeah, and I have Michael who says, you can do it, you can do it.
Isn't that the best?
Well, yes.
Yes, it is. And when I was reading Joy Every Day, I want to eat this food every day, but I'm curious because it makes it sound like you cook at home a lot.
I do.
And
I do.
That's incredible. So do you, but on the other hand, many of these recipes are inspired by having a meal someplace else, and you find one little thing. And, you know, each of your recipes inside of them is the one little thing that makes you say, oh, I didn't think of that before. Like what were you going to say?
Yeah. No, just say that's my favorite part of developing a recipe. Can I find a place to surprise you? Can I tuck in a little bit of crunch that you didn't think you were going to have, or a spice that you didn't think belonged in, that you'd never had in a dish of that kind? The most fun is when you take something that people know really well and do something a little wacky with it.
And so, give me an example of that.
So, I put walnuts in the meatballs for meatballs and spaghetti. Mm. Because as much as I like meatballs, they're kind of boring. You know, every bite's the same.
There's no crunch.
And so putting the walnuts in, a little bit of crunch, and the unexpected. Like, I love in a chocolate chip cookie not to use chips. Because chips just sit there. You know, they melt, but they're the same size everywhere. So I love to chop really good chocolate, and I like to have pieces of different sizes, shards, little, you know, slivers, and to put the dust in too, so you get a kind of Tweety look. And then every time you take a bite, you don't know what you're going to get. Are you going to get a lot of chocolate, just a little bit? Are you only going to get the dust? So it's this idea of something being unexpected, something that gives you pleasure, that makes you want to go back for another spoonful, another cookie, another. I was making what started out to be a kind of classic French beef stew with red wine and marinating the beef a night ahead. And I don't know, I got carried away. I found gochujang in the refrigerator.
Wow.
Well, you know, you buy it, you really only use a little bit of it,
yes.
And then it just sits in your fridge, and there it was, sitting in the fridge. Mm-hmm. And so I added that and some soy sauce and some star anise, which I adore with beef. Mm. And then I just opened the freezer, and there were these frozen cranberries. And I thought, ooh, they have tang, they're tart, they're kind of puckery.
Right.
And I put them in the stew.
And different too. From a cherry. I mean, like, there's a relation.
That's right.
Yeah.
Different from a cherry, not sweet.
Not sweet.
It's that's when it's really fun to be in the kitchen. And that's when it's exciting to share with readers.
Right.
And other cooks.
I keep thinking to myself, like, you're so sprightly as a human. And I think that there's something in you just want to sprinkle fairy dust in people's lives.
Oh, if only I could.
Like, there's something, but that's what the recipes do, because they're so, you know, there's so much charm in the writing. You know, I just feel the joy in choosing the different words, you know.
Thank you,
not describing something in a dry way, but describing it in a really, like, human, lively
But that's way. that's the fun of writing. That and writing for me is not easy, and it's not fast. I'm such a slow writer, but it's fun to find a new word. It's fun to sometimes.
I love that. It's so hard in recipes. Just having
Because the vocabulary for recipes can be limited. Absolutely. Or limiting. Sometimes I'll look down and I'll be at my computer and I'll see that my hands are doing something, and they're recreating the motion of making something. So I might be twisting a cheese straw. Or shaping a piece of dough, or slight, it's kind of a giggle when I see myself doing that. But I'm actually trying physically
new word by doing it and looking at observing yourself and going, so what would that be when you twist? Yeah.
Yeah, so sometimes a twist is just a twist.
Well, right, you can't have a book, and it isn't overladen with cleverness, right? Because that's also unappealing.
I feel like this book, of all my books, is probably the most practical. Mm-hmm. I live in three places. I always say I live in three kitchens. And we've been spending a lot of time in Connecticut. And we're not in a city in Connecticut. We're not even in a suburb. So we're really far from, you know, if I forget something, it's an hour round trip. And so this book, all of the testing and a lot of the development was done in Connecticut. So there's a lot of opening the fridge and looking at my favorite part of the refrigerator, which is the door that has all the ready-mades and condiments, and thinking, okay, what can I use to make this dish come alive?
Okay, we really need to talk about this. You wouldn't know, but this is the exact time in my life that I need this conversation, and I'll tell you why. So I have two kids, and my son William has gone off to boarding school, and my daughter Sylvie has gone off to college. And when they were home and we were cooking every single night, I mean, frankly, it wasn't me cooking every single night, but they were eating every single day, we had a full refrigerator. And now I need to take a completely different approach, because I'm fanatical. I try to be fanatical about no food waste. And I'm fanatical about surprise experience deliciousness. So somehow I need to fill the side of my refrigerator, the door, with something that unexpectedly will take, because I'll buy the proteins, go to the farmer's market. There's a great Hudson Valley duck that I get. I'll get, you know, we buy like part of a cow, because of course, how could I not? So, you know, we have some cow pieces, and, you know, I have like a gigantic pork chop that's just defrosting, but they're very boring if I do them the way I would do them. So in your book, the thing that I fell in love with fastest, and I feel like I can do this, although it felt like there's actually a lot of handwork in it, is the lemon goop. Partly I fell in love because the idea that you call it goop, back to our thing about words, like, I bet it does feel like goop, goop. It's great.
I'm so glad that. So I often worry, as a worrier, that no one will look at the back of the book. And so in Everyday Dory, I have, you know, the starters, the nibbles, the hors d'oeuvres. I have, you know, meat, fish, chicken, vegetables, a lot of vegetables, and desserts, of course. And then in the back, it's a chapter called Basics and Transformers. And it doesn't have pictures the way the rest of the book does. So I think people are going to ignore it. But you didn't. Because in that last chapter is the lemon goop. So what it is I love preserved lemons, the Moroccan preserved lemons, salted lemons. And when I'm in Paris, you can just go downstairs to the convenience store and get them. But in Nowhere, Connecticut, it's not so easy. And I am not patient enough to wait weeks and or months for the lemons to preserve. And so this goop is whole lemons, some of them peeled, some not.
Is it essentially supremed, though? Is that?
Well, you don't, but yes, it's just, so it's segments of, but when you said there's handwork, you can just chop them up because in the end.
That's what I wanted to hear.
Yes, so what you're doing is you're cooking the lemon pulp, the segments, and a bunch of the zest in a mixture of water, sugar, and salt until they just about fall apart. You drain them. The syrup that's left over, this is a twofer recipe. You get syrup, which is great to splash into marinades. It can be used to make a vinaigrette. Sometimes I'll just brush it over a chicken breast. Right? Then you've got all the falling apart solids, and you just whir them in a little food processor or with a blender with a little bit of the syrup, and you get the goop. And the goop, it's almost like, it's shiny, it's almost like jam, and it's salty, and it's sweet, and it's tangy, and it's just, it's a little miracle food. So if you're just like searing scallops, sear the scallops, just take a brush and go swipe, or a knife, it changes. It transforms everything.
I can't wait to do that. But I think you were about to tell me that I could zest the lemon and then I could chop it as opposed to taking the membranes.
So this
is... Not to get too detailed, people, sorry, but I'm really...
So call me silly. I get great pleasure out of getting the segments out of a lemon or a lime, right?
That's just
like
not
cutting
me.
It, yeah. They look so pretty, and then you're left with that kind of circular fan of membrane, which you can just squeeze and get extra juice out of.
This isn't video, because the joy that Dory's getting from squeezing her circular membrane is really pretty tremendous.
But I think that's one. Cooking, baking, being in the kitchen, I think that it doesn't take a lot of talent, it doesn't take a lot of skill, but I think it takes understanding that there's pleasure in every step.
Yeah.
And so if you can find something to enjoy in every step of the process, I'm convinced your food tastes better.
I am 100% sure you're right. When I look at today's cookbooks, and then I look at today's kitchens, I feel like there's an interesting potential disjunction, right? In that the cookbooks, in that the kitchens are being modernized by advancing technology, AI, smart equipment, and so, I mean, there are, of course, there's cookbooks for pressure cookers and Instapots. But what do you think about the technology-driven kitchen?
I don't really have one, and I've never really worked in one. I have an Instapot. I had a bread machine. Julia made me get it. she said, I said, I don't want it. She said, you have to learn about it. I have processors and blenders and, you know, I have a ton of gear. I don't have much in the way of press a button and it will cook dinner for you kind of equipment. And call me old-fashioned. I love working with my hands. And I feel like, and this has been true, it's been true for a while now, there are so few things that we can make by ourselves from start to finish. Mm-hmm. We work so collaboratively. We work in communities, all of which is good, but we never get the satisfaction that comes from really making something. And I think that's what we can do in the kitchen. We can touch the food, we can change it, we can transform it, we can make something that we love, and we can share it with people. And you know, I'm happy to have technology. A Tuesday night technology would be great. I mean, we can't, you know, but I never want to lose what it means to make something by hand.
Yeah, I think that's beautiful. I'm going to close out with that thought in terms of questions, but there's always one bonus and speaking broadly, and that's paying it forward. So is there a woman in the food world today who you're really excited by what they're doing? It could be a cookbook author, it could be a farmer, it could be anyone who's inspiring you as you go forward in this world.
Gee, there's so many. I feel like the cookbook world is just growing and growing and growing in the nicest way. I love what Julia Tertian is doing. I love what Emily did with the Paula Wolfert.
Emily Phelan with Unforgettable, about right. Paula Wolfert.
I feel like, why would you pin me down to one person?
Well, you already have two, so I'm giving you one more.
Okay, so let me think who it would be. I'm still inspired by the women whose books really changed me. By Maida Heder, mm-hmm. whose baking books I adored.
She was my first baking cookbook, and she was so brilliant.
So brilliant. Do you know she's 101?
Oh, wow. She lives in Miami?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've never met her.
What?
I feel like I know her so well because I think I've baked everything that she's ever written about, but I've never met her.
Amazing.
Yeah, so let me go back. I went forward. I went forward twice, but just let me go back a little bit with,
great.
With Maida.
Okay, that's lovely. Bonus question number two. You live in three places. If you were to walk out of here and go to one restaurant for your perfect meal, or like a delightful, perfect I don't believe in, for a delicious meal, where would you go?
I probably would walk to Paris. And I might just go right down the street from our apartment to Le Vin Comptoir, which is just a wine bar, but it's my, you know, it's my neighborhood.
Yves Comptoir is the chef.
Yeah, yeah, and it's such a, you know, I think that going out for food is a combination. Food in general, it's never just the food. It's who's around you, how you feel, how you're made to feel when you're there. And when I go to Le Vin Comptoir, and when we're in Paris, we're usually in and out every day, even if it's just to say hi. I feel like it's my second home, but the croquettes are better.
And with that, I want to thank you, Dory, for coming on to Speaking Broadly. Everybody, you have to go check out Everyday Dory, the way I cook is the way I want to cook, and you will want to cook as well. If people want to follow you on social, where will they find you?
At Dory Greenspan.
Pretty simple. Mm-hmm. And you know where to find me, at FW Scout. I want to thank my engineer of the day, Matt, and also a new addition to the Speaking Broadly family, Nina. Thank you so much for coming today, and we'll be back next week. We look forward to having you join us again for another inspiring person in the world of food.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.